First case of the day, 06-3711, Laborers' Pension Fund versus Laycom, Inc. For the appellant, Mr. Elliott.
Your Honor, may it please the Court, my name is Tim Elliott, and I represent four parties in this appeal who are all defendants in the district court case below: Laycom, Lord & Essex, the Lay Trust, and John Popp individually. I may refer to them collectively as the Laycom entities today, just to avoid repetitively reciting those four names.
That's Popp Jr., right?
John Popp Jr., that's correct. I would like to begin today by emphasizing two points which I think may have been lost in the district court and I hope will not be lost before this court. The first point is this. This is a dispute with three groups of defendants. When the union's pension obligations went unpaid, they sued three groups of defendants. The first were the companies that they actually contracted with, which is M.A. King and King & Larson Construction. Those were the entities that actually incurred the obligations at issue. They also sued a second group of defendants, which were the members of the King family that owned and operated the business, Michael King and his wife and one other. The third group of defendants are the Laycom entities who came to this situation very late in the day, many years after the contracts had been signed with King & Larson. Of those three groups of defendants, my clients, the Laycom entities, had by far the least amount of dealing with the unions. In fact, if you look in the record, you'll see that my clients never had any direct dealings with the unions. However, my clients were the only ones who actively showed up and defended themselves in the district courts. The other parties either defaulted or simply nominally appeared and didn't file any subsequent pleadings. In addition, my clients were the only ones that had any money, or at least appeared to have any money, which put a big bullseye on the Laycom entities. So I want to emphasize, we are the only defendants here before you today, but I hope you will recognize that there are two other groups of defendants in this case, and that we are before you not because of our proximity to the transactions at issue, but because of our perceived wealth. The funds, I think it bears mention.
That's true of a lot of defendants, isn't it?
I'm sure it is, and I think it bears mention that the funds actually voluntarily dismissed their claims against the members of the King family once they secured a judgment against us. They're not even bothering to pursue them anymore. The second point that I'd like to make is that Laycom, with respect to Michael King and M.A. King, is in the same position as the funds. We are a judgment creditor of M.A. King.
Well, didn't Laycom essentially control M.A. King? You had this deal with them where they couldn't spend any money without your specific permission. How could they?
Well, I guess I would say two points about that. The first is we did have that arrangement. Like any secured lender that's extending credit to a company, we put mechanisms in place to protect ourselves. The most significant of which is that M.A. King could not impair the collateral for our extension of credit without our permission. And that's a relatively standard provision for a secured lender. I think the second point I'd make is, on paper, that should have given us a lot of influence in the affairs of M.A. King. I think the undisputed facts show that just wasn't the case, because Michael King immediately went out and began taking actions to impair the collateral and to take on obligations for his company that we didn't approve and we didn't think the company could support. Chief among those is the obligation to the funds. And that leads me back to the point that I was making, which was we put money into M.A. King. We invested money to M.A. King. We extended credit to M.A. King. And Laycom lost its shirt on this transaction. We had to file a lawsuit against M.A. King. We couldn't enforce the judgment because M.A. King is essentially judgment-proof. So now we are really in the same position as the funds. We are trying to get our money back from M.A. King. In fact, I would say that Laycom is actually in a worse position than the funds for this reason. M.A. King took the money that Laycom put into the company and paid it to them. Part of the money that we put into this company went to them, and that was against the terms of the lending agreements and the lease agreements that Laycom had. M.A. King saddled this company, or Michael King saddled this company, with obligations that Laycom did not give him permission to undertake and which Laycom did not contemplate that the company would undertake.
Wasn't King doing a great deal of work for Laycom or Lord & Essex?
He was, through King and Larson, he was doing some amount of work with Lord & Essex. I don't believe there was at least a material business relationship directly with Laycom, but there were some dealings between Michael King and Lord & Essex. So some of the transactions that you see reflected in the papers are ordinary course transactions where one party is paying the other for services provided.
But what You're about not contesting that M.A. King is the successor company to King and Larson, I gather, is that right?
No, we are not contesting that fact. In fact, it's our contention that by naming M.A. King as a successor to King and Larson, that the district court did what was necessary to rejoin the assets and liabilities of King and Larson and put the funds in the same position to collect that they would have been had those transactions never occurred.
Well, what was the point of this moving these assets and some of the liabilities? You didn't move the union liabilities, as I understand it, but you moved everything else from up to Lord & Essex and then over to Laycom and eventually to M.A. King. What was the point of that?
Well, the transactions created really two opportunities. It created an opportunity for Michael King because he realized that he couldn't continue to operate with King and Larson, and if he was going to continue to operate, he was going to need to establish a new company. So it created an opportunity for him. It also separately created an opportunity for Laycom. It was an advantageous opportunity where Laycom could acquire these assets, which it did, paying due consideration, and then lease them back to M.A. King in exchange for payments from M.A. King. Now, Laycom went into this transaction with its eyes wide open. They recognized who they were dealing with. They were dealing with the person who had stiffed a lot of people in his last business, and that's why you see...
Including some of the Laycom interest, right?
Correct. That's why you see the structure of the agreement between Laycom and M.A. King, where Laycom says, we are leasing or selling these assets to you, depending on the various asset. But we insist that you take the following steps to protect our interest here, because to the extent that Laycom has a security interest in these goods and they're undersecured, that security interest is worthless.
It doesn't sound very advantageous where they didn't trust him any more than that.
Well, Laycom's belief was that if M.A. King adhered to the terms of that agreement, that M.A. King had sufficient business that it could meet its business needs and make the payments back to Laycom. Otherwise, why would Laycom have even engaged in that transaction?
They believe. Sorry, my question. Yeah. I don't understand that. I was trying to figure out is this an effort to try to, Laycom's already in the hole and they're trying to maybe extricate value and get back? Are they behind when it comes to M.A. King?
Well,
are they owed money? I'm trying to figure out why Laycom would do this, frankly.
I guess there's two steps to that answer. The first step is the entity that primarily dealt with King and Larson, which is the original entity, was Lord & Essex. Laycom only entered the picture because Lord & Essex didn't have the capital to acquire these assets from King and Larson, and so Laycom had to extend the capital. And that's why you see this transaction where it flows through to Laycom, because Laycom was the source of the funding. Laycom acquired equipment, it acquired receivables, it acquired works in progress. Those assets aren't valuable to Laycom because Laycom is not in the same business as M.A. King. Laycom's not an excavating contractor. So those assets are only valuable to Laycom if Laycom can then find a buyer or a leasor to lease or sell these assets to. In this instance, Michael King approached Laycom and said, well, if you buy it, you can lease it back to me, to a new company that I will operate. So Laycom agreed to take on these assets and liabilities only because it knew that it would have a ready and willing buyer at the other end of the transaction. If that opportunity didn't present itself to Laycom, Laycom would have presumably had to have found another excavating contractor with a need for this equipment and these type of works in progress. And if Laycom couldn't have found that, they probably wouldn't have gone through with the transaction.
So this is just an investment?
It's an investment opportunity for Laycom to acquire these assets
And lease them back?
And then lease them to a new entity. But again, Laycom, unlike the funds, acted as a prudent investor and recognized who it was dealing with and took steps to protect its interests. Ultimately, those steps failed because Michael King breached virtually every one of the covenants that he made with Laycom, leaving Laycom as another creditor, another judgment creditor of M.A. King.
Of course, they say that they hollowed out M.A. King of all of its assets and left the liabilities behind and continued the business somehow or other. That's what they say.
Well, I think that that's their allegation with respect to King and Larson.
Okay.
In our brief, we walked through the different transactions and showed, I think, as best as this record allows, that there was reasonably equivalent consideration provided for that. In the initial transaction where the certain of the assets and liabilities of King and Larson were transferred to Lord & Essex, if you look at that, there's about $1.9 or $2 million worth of assets and about $1.9 or $2 million worth of consideration paid.
Well, there was a large loan from Laycom to, allegedly a large loan from Laycom to King when they were starting out, right?
That's correct, and that loan was actually made.
Judge Shader said there wasn't any evidence of the loan, as I recall, among other things.
Well, we disagree.
There's not that much evidence of anything in this case. That's one of the problems.
Which is one of the reasons why we believe on some of these points summary judgment was inappropriate. In a number of instances, we feel that Judge Shader, and in the response brief, the pension funds deviated from the record and engaged in some speculation. On that loan, a couple points. The loan predated the master lease agreement, which is the overarching Laycom M.A. King agreement, by several weeks. And the loan is evidenced by the note, the security agreement, and the other papers of underlying that loan. So there is evidence that the loan was made. I suppose the parties also could have put into evidence the checks or a balance sheet or a ledger from M.A. King showing receipt of the funds. They elected not to do that, but there certainly is evidence of the loan being made.
Well, you're claiming that the loan goes into the calculus of undercapitalization, that there wasn't undercapitalization because, in part, because they got all this money on the loan. I don't know whether that undercapitalization is a pretty elusive business I've discovered over the years, and I don't know what that loan signifies.
Well, and on the issue of undercapitalization, I would submit to you, I guess, a few points. First, this is a commercial. This is a case where parties are contracting with each other, and you know, under Illinois law, there is authority to say undercapitalization is less of a factor in that sort of a transaction where parties have the opportunity to conduct due diligence and figure out who it is to whom they're extending credit. I think the second point on undercapitalization is undercapitalization compared to what? You know, the law says on this subject says undercapitalization only occurs where a company doesn't have sufficient capital to nominally run a business. Now, when M.A. King was established, it was contemplated that it would not incur pension obligations. And what really sunk?
Now, how could that be assumed if they were in the, they were a contractor? I don't know how they could be a contractor without having a deal with the laborers union and contributing to this pension fund.
Well, there are plenty of non-union contracting shops. I know there are, for example, less in Cook County than in the Collar counties, but there are a number of those shops, and it was contemplated that this particular entity would not incur those obligations.
It'd be a different way of King's working. King had worked with unions continuously prior up to that, hadn't he?
Through King and Larson, he certainly had. I don't think there's any question about that. And, you know, one of their allegations is that between 1995 and 2001, King and Larson ran up a tab of $800,000 of unpaid union dues.
Well, if M.A. King was a successor company to King and Larson, I'm not sure I understand how they could operate without incurring obligations to the laborers' union.
Well, the idea was that M.A. King would not enter into a new contract with the unions or pay any of the obligations that King and Larson had incurred. And what happened here is M.A. King did take on those obligations against the wishes of a majority of its board of directors, who are my clients. That resulted in a situation where M.A. King didn't have adequate capital, and they made $100,000 worth of payments to the pension funds, and during that time didn't make a single payment to my clients, which is why I circle back to saying this is a situation where my clients put money into the company, didn't get anything out. The funds were paid with our money, and we're holding, in the same position as they are, a judgment against M.A. King.
You did direct some money. Your client did direct some money to the Lay Trust, though, didn't it? About $29,000-some.
Lord Nessex did direct money. I see him into my rebuttal time. But Lord Nessex did direct, it was around $20,000 to Lay Trust, and in our brief we acknowledged that they probably shouldn't have done that. It was essentially self-help. It was a non-mutual set-off. I understand why they did it, but that shouldn't give rise to a finding that Lord Nessex is responsible for the entirety of the King and Larson M.A. King obligations to the funds. At most, that ought to give rise to a judgment saying you got to pay $29,000 back.
I know you're in your rebuttal time, but I'm curious about your comment about your claim that there should not have been summary judgment. I understood from your briefs that you accepted the facts that Judge Shader found and felt that you should win on those facts.
There is one issue in particular where we don't believe he could have, in order to rule in favor of the funds, we believe Judge Shader left the record and made certain findings. We believe that he could find in our favor on the issue of undercapitalization, sticking to the record. What he did was to say, I'm going to disregard the $250,000 loan because I'm not sure it was made. I'm going to disregard the $25,000 capital contribution that we all agree wasn't made, but which he imputed to Laycom rather than Michael King. And then he said, I feel that this was undercapitalized. And our view was, well, there really is no testimony on what undercapitalization or what adequate capitalization would be if this business hadn't incurred these union obligations.
All right, thank you. Mr. Wallace.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Pat Wallace. I'm fund counsel for the laborers. Before diving into the meat of the argument, I'd like to just address a few points the counsel made that really weren't touched upon in the brief. The first is with regard to the three entities, the three groups the counsel identified. Obviously, we sought and obtained judgment against King and Larson and M.A. King, which wasn't worth the paper it was written on. We did dismiss out two of the King family members. We did obtain a judgment against Michael King, who filed a bankruptcy petition. We had the debt declared non-dischargeable, and we continue to chase Mr. King. So we didn't necessarily let Mr. King off the hook. His ex-wife and his mother, who we believe were thrust into the position, the officer positions that they had with the company, we did take no further action against them, and that was based on our assessment of the facts of the case. The other point I'd like to touch on again before diving into the substance is the reference to the Laycom entities taking all the prudent steps that a secured lender would take. And I think Your Honor touched upon the one point, which is that a typical lender doesn't then turn around and use the company it's lending. It would be akin to a bank loaning a company money and then having it build the structure that the bank is in. There's a relationship more than just a typical secured lender. And then despite all these prudent steps that they took to secure their interests, and despite their previous dealings, which counsel just acknowledged, gave them pause for concern, they treat MA King by not policing the documents whatsoever until the union gets involved. MA King, it's undisputed, makes no repayments under the MLA, the Master Lease Agreement, makes no payments under the loan, and we're going to do what Judge Shader did. We like the loan. We're going to assume arguendo the loan was made, which is what the judge did in his decision. I think it's evidence of undercapitalization. But no payments were made under the loan, and I'd like to point out, and this is something that I don't think either of the parties touched upon in their briefs, that loan was made on April 1st, shortly after MA King was incorporated, and the first payment was due on April 31st and was never made. Again, this is a point that's conceded by counsel in their briefs. So no payments were ever made under the $250,000 loan, so again, assuming arguendo that it was funded, they were already in breach of the loan before the master lease agreement was even entered into.
Why is that evidence of undercapitalization?
Well, because the fact that they required a loan at their inception shows that they weren't properly capitalized. They had to go out and borrow more money just to fund their operations.
Did they become capitalized after they got the loan?
Yeah, but there's no actual capital to the company. And again, the reason why we argue undercapitalization here is because MA King or the Laycom entities are first lien secured lenders. And as I go through the facts of undercapitalization, I think you'll see exactly what happened here. It's our contention that MA King was propped up for a construction season, that the Laycom entities benefited from the use of their work, and then at the end of the construction season, the plug was pulled, and they swept in and took first lien secured interest in all receivables. So to address the first and strongest point regarding the unity of interest is the inadequate capitalization. The first point I'd like to make is, of course, that they had no assets, no equipment themselves. All the equipment was leased by Laycom. So they had no equipment. The $250,000 loan, again, is, in my opinion, in courts have held evidence of undercapitalization, a loan at its inception. And once again, the loan was never repaid to Laycom. All the payments were missed. No stock was ever issued. This GAK trust was created to purchase the stock, but the stock was never purchased. No stock was ever issued, which in and of itself is a separate element of indicating a unity of interest.
GAK stands for Gale King, is that?
Pardon?
I say GAK stands for Gale King. Is that correct?
I'm not sure, Your Honor. I don't know why they named it GAK Trust. The other item that the appellates go to great length to emphasize is the assignment of the receivables from King and Larson. And on this point, there's a couple holes in their argument. First of all, the receivables that were assigned, in addition to assigning the receivables, MA King assumed a significant portion of the liabilities, and as the court pointed out, in excess of $1.5 million in liabilities. It's hard. It's sort of arguing out of both sides of your mouth in the extent that, on the one hand, they're arguing that King and Larson and MA King, the funds should have never entered into any agreements because they were undercapitalized, but at the same time, they were adequately capitalized to avoid the veil-piercing argument. With regard to those receivables, again, the receivables, it's kind of a ghost transaction. The receivables were already in the possession of M.A. King, but M.A. King was already in default on the April 1st note for $250,000. So Laycom, the minute they gave them the receivables, already had a secured interest above M.A. King in the receivables. They could take them back at any time. The date the MLA was entered into, Laycom could have swept in there the next day and took the receivables right back. And then the final thing, of course, is a point that was already touched upon. Some of those receivables for work performed by King and Larson, not by MA King, were actually paid directly to the lay trust. So even though the receivables were assigned, Lord in Essex was paying money directly to the lay trust, and there's no evidence, counsel referenced an offset, but there's no evidence that that offset was ever applied to the outstanding MLA.
I'd like to pursue the question of why the lay trust is included in the bail piercing finding. That was presumably based on the fact that they advanced some money to M.A. King at one point. Now, why did that adversely affect your interest in M.A. King? It seems to me that helped you. It gave them more money to pay their debts.
Well, that's an argument.
Why should we include the lay trust in this bail piercing?
Well, and that really leads to my second part, the promotes injustice test, because
does that promote injustice?
Because lay trust.
Money to the debtor. Why does that promote injustice?
Because we incurred an additional $820,000 of liability from M.A. King's operation. And this goes to the issue of why we went after M.A. King. The funds did their legal obligation. They chased a legal successor, which hasn't been denied here. The fact that
I'm talking about the lay trust. Why should they be liable?
The lay trust was at all times relevant, the 100% shareholder of both Lord in Essex and Laycom.
I beg your pardon?
They were the 100% shareholder of both Lord in Essex and Laycom at all times relevant. Eventually, the shares of Lord in Essex were transferred to Bob.
That doesn't justify it.
But they also funded a lot of the monies that were paid either directly to M.A. King or through Lord in Essex and Laycom. In other words, the monies went from the lay trust to Laycom and Lord in Essex to fund the deals. And that's why they're included.
Why was that an injustice to your client?
Because it permitted M.A. King to operate and incur additional liabilities. Counsel references the fact that we received nearly $100,000 from M.A. King in money that shouldn't have been paid over. But in the meantime, of the judgment, the $2.5 million judgment, $800,000 of that liability was incurred through the operation of M.A. King. So it's our suggestion in the promotes injustice analysis of the veil piercing that, and Judge Shader agreed, that keeping this company afloat did more. It wasn't just that they were, I'm trying to draw an analogy. This isn't a situation where someone buys some shares of stock and then
somebody advances capital to an undercapitalized situation. That makes them liable under a bail piercing theory, is it?
Well, in this set of facts, I would suggest it does, absolutely, because what it does is it enables that company to continue to operate and incur more liability to its legitimate creditors,
well,
such as the funds.
It also makes them able to pay their debts, doesn't it?
Not in this case, it didn't, at least for the funds, and that's our point. Again, $100,000 versus the additional $820,000 in liability, we'd have given back the $100,000 if we could have $800,000 less in liability. That's what the heart of the promotes injustice analysis is. If you'd like, I could go straight into that. I think there's clearly a unity of interest between the two entities for all the reasons that the court discussed and that
we
discussed.
Well, I don't see why the late trust is any different from Mr. Pop Jr. He was one of the trustees of the late trust.
Mr. Pop Jr., I believe, became the trustee of the lay trust after Pop Sr. passed, and that's when he was added as a defendant. I'm seeking liability against Mr. Pop individually, not just in his capacity as the trustee of the lay trust, and that's something that we've challenged.
Well, they were both in an ownership role with respect to these other companies, but I'm not sure that's enough to drag them into the veil piercing.
Well, again, and this goes to the argument with regard to Mr. Pop Jr. Corporations cannot act by themselves. They need directors. We're seeking to attach liability to Pop Jr., not just in his capacity as an officer or shareholder of Lord in Essex or Laycom, but in his capacity as a controlling director of M.A. King Construction. Pop Sr. and Pop Jr. were actually the two controlling directors. Mike King was a director as well, but obviously Pop Sr. and Pop Jr. were at the helm of M.A. King throughout its operation. This isn't just a situation where the company invested and then had nothing to do. They were on the board of directors. And I understand it might be a clearer case if, for example, some of the equipment was taken and sold and the money went directly into Pop Junior's pocket. But I would suggest that running an entity, a shell of an entity like M.A. King, for the benefit of corporations where you do draw a paycheck from, is sufficient evidence that he had pecuniary gain from the operation of M.A. King. There doesn't need to be, in our opinion, $500,000 going into Pop Junior's pocket directly. You know, the promote injustice analysis, again, we agree with the district court, obviously. I'd like to point out that the appellates suggest in their briefs that the total amount of $865,112 was invested and that they actually lost as a result. And I would suggest that the facts are clearly opposite. Of the $865,000, $347,000 of it was the initial loans to King and Larson that were extinguished through the assignment. There's the $250,000 loan, which we've already discussed. And there's $267,908 of additional payments that were made without any loan documentation, and as Judge Shader touched upon in his decision, are evidence of the lack of arm's-length transactions between the two entities. The value of the equipment alone, and I know the appellate suggests that there's not enough evidence, and I would suggest that it was not at the district court level plaintiff's fault that there weren't enough evidence. This is a case that's involved a lot of doctor's notes. Unfortunately, Mr. Pop Sr. passed away before we even had an opportunity to depose him in the case. But one thing is clear. The value of the equipment was appraised pursuant to a liquidation appraisal in June of 2001, shortly after the MLA was entered into. And it appraised for $1.043 to $1.097 million. That was the estimate from the appraisal. There is no evidence in the record of how the equipment was sold, but we have to presume, I think, that it was sold for the fair market value, the best estimate that we have in the evidence. And I believe Mr. Pop Sr. was the person who dealt with that, and we received no records of how the equipment was disposed of. But if you take that $1 million appraisal value, and I know appellates try to knock the value down to $593,000, suggesting that that's the only equipment that came from King and Larson. But in addition, the money that they reference in their $800,000 figure includes monies that were used to purchase additional equipment. So that $800,000 is completely captured, and if they got the appraised value of the equipment, they're $200,000 in the black already. And that's before you take into account the fact that M.A. King rendered a full year's worth of services to Lord and Essex, putting concrete in for their houses. And that's before you take into account, and again, the record is a little bit admittedly spotty on this point, the collection of receivables. The only collection record that's evidence that's in the record is after they got their agreed judgment from Mike King and the company, they attempted to and obtained a turnover order of $533,000 against some of the creditors of M.A. King. Now, that was eventually turned over, reversed on appeal at the state court because the underlying judgment was declared void. But they were clearly trying to collect the receivables. Our version of events is quite simply put. They invested money to create M.A. King. They ran it for a season. They pulled the carpet out, and they took all the proceeds and left all the legitimate creditors, including the funds, in the lurch. As far as applying the judgment to the lay trust and to John Pop individually, again, as I've said, it's our position that a company can't run itself, that Pop Jr. And the lay trust, which was substituted for Pop Sr., they ran the company. They were, in essence, running the company. They benefited from the company by virtue of the payments they received. Pop Jr., although not receiving any money directly from M.A. King, received the value by virtue of the fact that it benefited the companies that he was drawing a paycheck from. So we believe that the court didn't go as far as it should have, and it should have imposed liability against Pop Jr. In his individual capacity, not just as a trustee of the lay trust.
What does the fund do during this period of time when you're saying that they are propping up M.A. King in order to benefit from the work? Apparently, they're paying the employees, or M.A. King is.
That's correct.
What? But they're not paying the fund. These are covered employees, and they're not paying the fund for the pension benefits.
That's correct. Our lawsuit was filed in August of 2001.
While they're in full, while they're working.
The $100,000 that counsel references was monies that were being paid on behalf of King and Larson. M.A. King was discovered operating, and then we went after M.A. King as well under the theory
that
they
gave the $100,000 that the Laycom people say they didn't approve.
That's correct.
And
that's correct.
That's all the money that you got, I guess.
That's correct.
You owed $800,000 or something, and then some more. I guess I maybe there's nothing more you can do, but at some point somebody's got to stop working, or if you keep incurring these deficits.
Well, and that's exactly what happened. Actually, what happened is, and the reason why Mike King eventually signed a contract in September of 2001, is that the employees started to engage in a job action. They started to stop working. The employees were unaware
of the reason.
Absolutely. They were getting
they were getting paid.
They were getting paid their same scale that they would have earned if they were a union company.
But so they knew that the pension wasn't being funded.
They were unaware. There's nothing in the record, but I would suggest that they're unaware. A typical laborer is unaware that he's not getting contributions paid probably for 3 months, which would equate to the fact that there's a three-month lag in when a typical laborer finds out. They get quarterly statements that show what hours have been paid in. They're typically unaware of it unless they make a specific inquiry.
No, but you're aware. Your client's aware of it.
Well, again, that $100,000, they were funding the King and Larson obligations. I don't know when the union becomes aware. The funds, of course, are not out in the field like the union.
Okay.
The union becomes aware at some point that there is a second entity, and that's when the job action starts up. And we had already sued in August. I think the job action was underway. Again, the timing's not really in the record. But there was a job action that precipitated him signing the September 11th agreement. So when the guys became aware of it, they took action. So I don't know if the court has any other questions. I see I'm coming close to my time, but I got a little off track from my argument, as will happen. Couple of points. Obviously, there was no issuance of stock, which is another reason to suggest a unity of interest, as the court touched upon. In addition, of course, there's the what we would contend to be the draconian third-party distribution restriction, which requires that if any monies are paid out of the normal course of business, that M.A. King would have to get approval from the directors, meaning John Popp Jr. and John Popp Sr.
Who's operating out of the same building, same employees, et cetera, that makes this a successor or an alter ego or whatever you're calling it?
Yes. Same employees, same building, same equipment.
Who was that that was doing that?
M.A. King.
M.A. King was?
King and Larson was in a yard.
Okay, so there's not a lot of dispute on M.A. King. It's just beyond that.
That's correct. There's no dispute regarding M.A. King's liability.
Okay.
That has not been challenged.
But that's where that liability comes from, because they're operating the same business.
That's correct. And again,
but you're not saying that Laycom is a successor. You're not saying Laycom is a successor.
No, we're saying that we're piercing the veil of M.A. King to attach liability to Laycom.
Okay.
And I guess the last point I'd like to make, as my time is almost up, is that once again the funds are not entering into a contract here. They're not extending credit. They are receiving the situation as it is. They are pursuing their obligations against a successor company, doing what they have to do to prosecute the rights of their participants under ERISA. So to suggest that we foolishly entered into an arrangement with a company that had no financing, I think is a misstatement of the situation that actually took place.
Thank you. Mr. Elliott, how much time? 2 minutes.
2 minutes. Well, I'll try and be very brief. You know, so often in these cases, we get bogged down in details, and sometimes you lose the forest for the trees. So in closing, let me just suggest that if you take a step back for a second, you realize that the theory of the case that the funds are articulating just doesn't even make sense. You have King and Larson, which operates from 1995 to 2001. With no involvement from Lord Nessex or Laycom. And during that time, the funds are working with them, and during that time, King & Larson runs up an $800,000 tab, unpaid tab, to the funds. This is before my clients are even on the radar screen. Now, we put into evidence what the balance sheet of King & Larson looked like prior to my clients getting involved. How were the funds ever going to get paid back for that amount? They weren't. They just weren't. And what you hear is this allegation that Laycom and Lord Nessex jumped into this company and poured hundreds of thousands of dollars into this company without any real expectation of getting paid back. Why would they do that? My clients aren't stupid people. They're smart people. Why would they jump in to this company that already has all of these problems and invest hundreds of thousands of dollars without any expectation of being repaid back? That's really what they're saying. I think today we've heard for the first time in this case the allegation, which isn't in the record and isn't supported by any evidence, that what was really going on was that M.A. King was providing work for Lord Nessex and that they were propping up M.A. King so that it could finish working for Lord Nessex. There's a few problems with that. Number one, there's no evidence of that. Number two, if you look at the amount of money that my clients put in here, that's a pretty expensive tab to pay for propping up a company. Number three, if that's correct, you have to discount tremendously the value of those receivables that were transferred, because those receivables then would be Lord Nessex receivables. So if they really weren't going to get paid by Lord Nessex, then the value of those receivables is low. If Lord Nessex is paying, then it's a legitimate transaction. The value of the receivables is high and they're collectible. So their theory really doesn't make sense. And I guess my closing point to you is this. The purpose of veil piercing is to right a wrong. It's an equitable remedy that's to prevent an injustice. What did my clients do that frustrated the fund's legitimate expectation of getting repaid? What did my clients do? The funds were always in the same position. They extended credit to King & Larson for 6 years and had no real expectation of getting paid. They continued to do it with Michael King. They were suing M.A. King for payment and then entered into a new contract with him. But at the end of the day, even though everyone scrutinizes these transactions and this asset shifting, at the end of the day, there was the same pool available to pay that there was at the beginning of the day. And when you rejoin the assets and liabilities of M.A. King and King & Larson, you have accomplished that. Going the next step to Laycom and Lord Nessex, who were not enriched by this, who in reality had no control over these companies, who had no direct dealings with the pension funds, who didn't mislead the pension funds into doing business with M.A. King, who didn't cause them to incur this debt, who arrived on the scene after this debt was already incurred, that would be unprecedented under Illinois law for veil piercing. And I see that I'm out of time.
All right, just
let me ask a question about the lay trust. As I understood your opponent to say that the lay trust, they, of course, as we know, Judge Shader included them in primarily on the basis that they had made a direct contribution to M.A. King. Is that right?
I believe that's correct. There were some relatively low-dollar transactions.
He said that justified their inclusion because that helped to keep M.A. King going, I guess, and incurring more obligation. What's your response to that?
The contribution from the lay trust was a relatively low-dollar contribution. It did put money in, and as we said in our briefs, once Laycom had entered into this lease agreement and M.A. King wasn't paying, it really had two choices. It could either just call it quits, terminate the lease agreement, and try and find someone else who could do something with this equipment, or it could keep giving money to M.A. King in the hopes that M.A. King would somehow turn the corner and become profitable. We don't think that contribution justifies piercing the corporate veil. And I think, it, as you pointed out...
How much was it?
Pardon me?
How much was it?
I actually don't have the dollar amount in front of me right now. That contribution, as you point out, companies invest money in failing companies all the time. That's what distressed lending is. and extending credit to a company to keep it going shouldn't give rise to liability on the part of the lender. And that's what we really think happened here.
All right. Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement.